Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest is Shauna Farrell, and she is the author of a wonderful new book, A Good Drink. And I will tell you more about Shauna and what she does in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with all of you. I want to first share with you that this was a big weekend for me and my family. We celebrated the marriage of my son up in the Hudson Valley, and it was just a gorgeous setting right on the Hudson River. We had the fall foliage behind us, and it was beautiful. Unfortunately, the clouds came rolling in. We managed to get the ceremony in outdoors before the rain came, but it was a very wet, thunderstorm-filled party. Luckily, we had lots of tents, but it was wet. But it was a lot of fun, and you know, and I'll tell you more about it in a little while, but I was standing at the bar looking at all the bottles behind the bar, and I was thinking about this week's guest with A Good Drink, and we will talk more about all those bottles and what makes different bottles special and what spirits to look out for. But this week there's, you know, I wrote about lead in the pipes in New York City, especially in public schools. All the old buildings in New York City still have lead pipes. And I remember when my kids were going to public school 20 years ago, I was talking to our public school here in the suburbs about lead pipes. And nobody even wanted to open that Pandora's box because they just knew what would be involved if it really came out that there was lead in the pipes. And sure enough, years later, it did come out and they did have to fix the pipes in our school. But in New York City, those lead pipes are still there. And they're in so many of the apartment buildings as well that so many kids live in. And we really need to take some action. And our new governor, Governor Hochul, needs to hear from all of us and needs to hear that we want to take action. We want them to put some money into the infrastructure in these old school buildings and get the lead pipes out. I'm sure most of you know that the neurotoxins that is in lead is really very, very dangerous for children, for their brain development, for autoimmune diseases. It's just learning disabilities. It's just bad, bad. And, you know, the amount of lead that an adult can withstand is certainly greater than the amount a child can stand up to. So please sign my petition to try to get some of this lead pipes out of the schools. I also wrote about a wonderful article. It wasn't that the article was so wonderful, but it's just the conversation about whether plant-based meats are really better for the environment or not. And there was an article in the New York Times this week, and it is a question. I mean, they are looking at all the different sources of the different products that go into making plant-based meat alternatives. You know, when you have meat, if you're getting sustainably raised meat, and you know, those of you that know me know that I follow a plant-based diet, so I'm not eating that meat. But if you're going to purchase meat that is raised in a sustainable way on a farm where the farmer is doing it the right way and grazing the cows and they're eating grass, is that better for the environment where they're, you know, pooping on the, in the fields and refertilizing the soil? Does that have a smaller footprint than these alternative meats that have 20, 25 ingredients? It's not completely transparent where all these ingredients come from. We know that the Impossible Burger contains genetically modified ingredients, which is definitely not a good thing. Beyond Burger is better than that. They don't contain any GMOs, but still there's 20 or so ingredients to make up that alternative meat burger. And what really goes into them, it's not so clear. And so this was just opening the discussion as to whether it's better or not. And, you know, I think it's better for our health. I certainly think, you know, cutting down on meat in any fashion, whether you're going to do meat alternatives or just eat lots of legumes and vegetables and other plant-based products, is certainly better for your health and the environment. But these alternative meats, what goes into them is really a question. So I just found that really, really interesting. I want to share with you my recipe this week. It's peanut butter and jelly cookies. And they actually are out of the one of my favorite recipes, which is kind of like a Linzer tart. It's super easy to make. These are gluten-free and vegan. You can use regular flour, and then they're not gluten-free, but I use gluten-free flour just so that everyone can eat them. And this recipe makes about 22 cookies the size of, I don't know, maybe 2-inch cookies or so, 3-inch cookies. So it's 1 cup of oats that you're going to ground, and you measure it after you grind them up. 1 cup of walnuts, also ground, measuring after you grind it. 1 cup of gluten-free flour, 1/4 teaspoon cinnamon, 1 pinch of salt, 1/2 cup of maple syrup, 1/2 cup of peanut butter, 2 tablespoons canola oil, and 1 jar of your favorite jam. You're going to preheat the oven to 350. You're going to combine all the ingredients except for the jam in a large bowl, roll it into 1-inch balls, and then you can press them down, creating a flat cookie, and then indent the center with your thumb, and you're going to fill that with the jam. And so these are just like the cookies I always make, except I've added the peanut butter. And it's really a nice take on peanut butter and jelly cookies. And as you can see, I set it in 5 minutes. It goes together just as quick. And it's really, really a delightful, delightful cookie. And like I said, it's vegan and gluten-free, so everybody can eat it, unless you have a nut allergy. Then you can't eat it. But you can substitute, you know, more gluten-free flour for that. You can amaranth flour, some tapioca flour, brown rice flour. There's certain other things you can put in there if you need to take the walnuts out. And now it's my pleasure to introduce all of you to Shanna Farrell. Shanna is a oral history interviewer at the UC Berkeley Oral History Center, where she works on a wide variety of projects and specializes in drink culture and environmental history. Her new book, A Good Drink, is a wonderful book devoted to the stories behind the drink, the how, where, and by whom the grain was grown. And it's also talking about how the good food movement is finally starting to carry over into the good drink movement. And going to take a look at the trend of high-end niche spirits that are entering the market, and see whether we think this is a trend that's going to stay or not stay. She's also the author of Bay Area Cocktails. Her writing has appeared in many magazines, Life and Time, Punch, and the San Francisco Chronicle, just to name a few. She holds a master's degree from both NYU and Columbia University, and I'm really so thrilled to have her with us. How are you, Shanna?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. So I thought we could just first start. I always like to ask my guests your own personal history. Like, how did you come to specialize and be passionate about drinks?
Sure. So I have been or had been bartending for about 15 years. And it started when I was in college and then when I was in graduate school. I was in graduate school. I was doing first an interdisciplinary master's degree, and I kind of called it environmental anthropology, so create your own adventure. And I was paying my bills by bartending. And during the shifts, I would see this really beautiful bottle on the back bar that was a whiskey made in New York State. And when I would read the bottle, I would kind of pick it up and turn it over in my hands. And it was labeled that it had came from 100% New York State grain. And I'd never really seen that on a bottle of alcohol before, the attribution to where the ingredients came from. And so it was something I got really interested in. And then fast forward to my second master's degree, which was actually in oral history, I was looking at water pollution and how it affected people differently along the Hudson River. So I was interviewing people who lived along the river in different parts, upstate, downstate. And because of my connection with bartending, I actually decided to interview that distiller who had used 100% New York State grain because they were set up along the banks of the Hudson. And so through the course of that interview, I learned that they had created a direct relationship with the farmer to source the grain. And I thought that was really interesting because you don't really hear distillers talk about where their ingredients are coming from. And so it really caught my attention. It stayed with me. Fast forward to a few years later, I'm living in San Francisco and I'm eating at a lot of restaurants that have where the lettuces are grown or where the farm that they source their protein comes from. And I started to notice that a lot of that was not translated to the bar. And so I started to just get more interested in this and talk to distillers and like-minded people who owned bars and were treating spirits as agricultural products. So that's kind of where the whole journey started.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. It's so funny how if you just allow your life to unfold, it kind of leads you down these paths that you don't set out to do, but it's where your passion finds you. And I know that's how it happened for me. So yeah. It's great to hear the stories of others.
Yeah.
So given the popularity of farm-to-table restaurants and buying locally grown food, why is the eco-consciousness devoted to what we eat often not extended to what we drink?
So I think there's a few reasons for this. One is that a lot of spirits are made with commodity crops. So things like a yellow dent corn for whiskey, sugarcane is considered a commodity crop, agave, also a commodity crop. And so there's this real disconnect. The crop seems to be faceless. If you take whiskey for an example, a lot of producers don't know what even state their corn is coming from. It's a faceless product. There's a complete disconnect. And if you don't even know what zip code the corn is coming from, there's this whole connection that's lost. So I think that that's one reason. And it's also a reason why a lot of whiskey producers don't talk about where the crop is being grown because they just don't know. So sourcing is one of the big reasons. And then another reason that I think is pretty important is the way that alcohol is regulated. So it's regulated by the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau, the TTB, instead of the Food and Drug Administration or the FDA. So a lot of the same rules that are applied to food don't translate to alcohol. And one great example of this is that when you go to the grocery store and you look at a box of cereal or you even look at a non-alcoholic beverage, the ingredients are all listed on the bottle. It's one of the requirements. But on alcohol, because they're regulated by the TTB, they don't actually have to list their ingredients on the bottle. So there is this lack of transparency. I will say that alcohol does have to follow the generally recognized as safe list. So all the ingredients have to be approved by the FDA. But you know, you could have a red dye number 40 in a bottle of alcohol to increase the texture of the body or the viscosity or something. Sorry, that's high fructose corn syrup. You can have red food dye to change the color. You can add high fructose corn syrup for that viscosity. You can add synthetic chemicals for a flavor or something like a mint or a banana and liqueurs, but that doesn't have to be transparent on the bottle. So I think that those are big reasons why we don't really treat spirits the same way, that eco-consciousness doesn't extend from the kitchen to the bar.
Mm-hmm. I've certainly seen it start to extend when you talk about beer, right? There's so many people now with all the craft breweries that are popping up, you know, people know where their grain's coming from and the hemp, you know, not the hemp, the
hops.
Hops, right. Thank you. The hops, you know, you see that growing on these long ropes. You know, as I drive out east, I see hop farms popping up now. What would consumers be surprised to learn about what's in their drink that they maybe are not expecting?
Yeah, I think this gets back to what I was just talking about the ingredients. There are definitely additives that go into alcohol. Not all spirits have additives, but a number of them do. And so they can get away with things like including that high fructose corn syrup or the red dye number 40. I will say that there's a very popular cocktail that calls for a bright red Italian aperitif. And that is not dyed naturally. That uses red dye number 40. And people don't really think about that. I will say, though, that if producers aren't really hiding behind anything, it's pretty easy to find when you go to their website. They're pretty above board about, you know, we don't use anything that's artificial. There's also caramel that can be added for color as well. That might be a natural ingredient, but it's still kind of a trick to add the illusion of age. So I think that those are pretty surprising, especially the high fructose corn syrup for that thickening agent too.
Mm-hmm. And what about, you know, I always think of the kids drink, you know, my kids always wanted to have one of those old fashions, you know, when they were little with the grenadine in the bottom, and I would never let them because I just assumed it was artificially colored. Am I correct? That's artificially colored, right?
It's yeah. I mean, chances are if it looks unnaturally colored, it probably is.
Right. Right. So many sustainable spirits are high-end products, you know, obviously very expensive, out of the reach for many people. Do you believe sustainable spirits will remain a niche product, or will they become more available and affordable as the industry grows? I mean, that has happened a little bit with some of these other foods, but not all. There's still, you know, people still say, why is organic so much more expensive? And what's your take on that?
Yeah, I'm hopeful that this will grow beyond just being a niche thing, and that people will start to want more of these products or ask for, you know, I want something that's grown, that's made with locally grown grain or something like that. Or I want something without these artificial additives. I do think that that's a reason why a lot of distillers, the cost part is why a lot of distillers use commodity crops, because it's cheaper and they're consistent and they know that they're going to sell. And the people that are using heirloom grains or are really thinking about the agaves and that they're using for their mezcal, or, you know, even where their sugarcane is coming from, those can drive the cost of the product up. So it can be a bit of a challenge. But there are different price points. I mean, some distilleries like High Wire in Charleston, South Carolina, they have an array of products, and they're not all super high end, but they're all kind of follow the same principles. And then I think about the Leopold brothers in Denver, Colorado, who are featured in the book, and their price point is a little bit lower than some of these other high end ones. So there are different entry points, but I do think that there are ways that distillers can save money when they're doing these things, thinking about energy use, thinking about solar power, about the, you know, not using chemicals, about composting things. This does drive down the cost. So it's kind of a complicated question, but I am hopeful that this topic is going to become more popular. And so consumers will start asking for these things, and then the market will follow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So even corn, which we know is most commodity corn, is genetically modified. So it's safe to assume then that the corn that's used in most liquor would be genetically modified as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, yes, a lot of whiskey producers are using a yellow dent corn that is a commodity crop, and it's used for its high sugar content, how consistent it is. It's pretty uniform in size. So you never have to worry about where your supply is coming from. In the first chapter of the book, I do again follow High Wire Distilling, and they use an heirloom varietal of corn called Jimmy Red. And particular type of corn is very bright red. It's a landrace grain, so it's an antebellum corn. And it was down to the last few cobs. The culinary community in Charleston was able to bring it back, and it's fantastic for distilling. It tastes really wonderful. But you know, the problem is scale there. when it's only being grown on a few different farms, you are really at the whims of the weather and what's happening environmentally that year. So it's less consistent. But I think that because these types of varietals that are not commodity add such flavor and character and also help a distillery have a unique voice and a place, that they're becoming more popular. So I think you're going to see these things popping up more and more.
Yeah. And I've also read about contracts that producers are having directly with the farmers, you know, growing, like I was talking about with the hops, growing for the farm. Or in St. Louis, Ann Arbor Busch, right? I think they can't get enough supplies to create whatever organic beer they have. And so they have contracted directly with farmers to grow some organic products for making their beer. Have you seen that in spirits as well?
Absolutely. And I think that that's one thing that people are starting to realize is possible. That's actually part of the Highwire story as well. The owners realized that they could create a direct relationship with a farm. They didn't know it was possible until they kind of looked into it a little more and had the conversations. And that actually in the end does help drive down some of the costs, because you don't have to pay for some of the shipping and logistics and that kind of thing. You are starting to see this a lot more. That even goes back to how I originally got involved in this, with that beautiful bottle that was produced along the Hudson River. They had created a direct relationship too. So I think a lot more farms are open to working directly with a distillery. Maker's Mark down in Kentucky, they do that as well. I went to visit the fourth generation family farm that they get their corn from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With the high-end restaurants, how are the small businesses and the bartenders there really kind of promoting the sustainable spirit movement?
This is definitely still catching on within the bar industry. I think it's becoming more of a topic within the distilling community, because, you know, there's more intense impacts of climate change and that kind of thing. So it's becoming a more pressing issue. But in terms of the bartenders, this is a little bit slower to catch on. I think that some people are really invested in this. Some people do really care, but it's a little bit siloed currently. There is one bartender based out of the UK. His name is Ryan Chetty-Wardana, and he is really interested in this and has lots of high-end bars. And what was really thinking about, you know, how do I make the bar more environmentally conscious, whether that's removing ice or whether that's batching drinks, whether that's buying things in bulk. The UK is subject to different regulation than the US. So you can buy alcohol there in bulk. You can't do that in the US. So there were some really interesting things he was doing with the buying in bulk, and then also creating a menu it was a botany-based menu to think about, you know, this connection to kind of have the guests at the bar think about where these things are coming from, all the botanicals and things like that. And then there was a bar in San Francisco where the owner was really thinking about sourcing spirits and how are they archetypes of the things that they're coming from. And when we strip all this stuff away, what is it really at its essence? And so that bar did go on to win lots of awards. Unfortunately, it closed during COVID. So we'll see what happens. But I think that, you know, the more that people are talking about this and caring about it, the more I'm hopeful that it will catch on as not just a trend, but as a staying power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I also think, you know, as a chef, you know, I was trying to go into schools and set up salad bars. And, you know, there's nothing worse than setting up a healthy salad bar for kids and then having them put like Heinz Russian dressing on the bar, right? So, you know, so I'm just thinking about, you know, these high-end spirits, you know, you get a beautiful rum and then what? They're going to go put Coca-Cola in it, or, you know, or a mixer that's, you know, is artificially colored, or, you know, even Rose's lime juice, which is, you know, a staple at so many bars, is artificially colored. You know, are you seeing the drinks or the side drinks that go along with the spirits? Are those catching on so that there's higher end mixers to go along with these so that you're not taking something that now is a quality product and then just, you know, watering it down with, you know, Bloody Mary mix.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, this is also where living in New York and San Francisco, you know, kind of at the epicenter of the cocktail revival, but people do care a lot more about using fresh juice as opposed to roses or something like that. So many bar programs all across the spectrum are using fresh juice and caring about ingredients. And then I also think too, you know, if you're going to spend let's say $20 at a bar on a pour of whiskey, you're not really going to, you want to taste that spirit and maybe not add ingredients to it. Just sip it on the rocks. When you're spending $80 on a bottle and bringing it home, trying to taste those kind of things. So I think that's where the price point of some of these sustainable spirits does lend itself to having a consumer really want to taste it by itself. But I will say that there are bars who are really caring about the other ingredients that are being added, you know, going to the farmer's market to get ingredients. So things are fresh, they're local, they're in season. These are things that are catching on all across the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to hear. Yeah. So you touched on, you know, that you can buy in bulk in the UK. What needs to happen for sustainable spirits to be produced and sold on large scale here?
I think that this is the question that everyone would love the answer to. I think that there's definitely a fragile balance between the environment and making spirits, because we want to be careful not to over-harvest certain ingredients. And that would mean keeping the ecosystem intact. There was a big trend with foraging ingredients. And, you know, if everyone goes out and forages, then we're depleting the supply of things that's not actually sustainable. So I think that a lot of businesses need better infrastructure so they can scale up, but that does involve more money. So that does get to be a little bit complicated. And you know, there are ways that distilleries can scale up. And actually that's what I discuss in the last chapter of the book. It's kind of how all these people, you know, whether they remain independent, whether they take investment money, whether they're moving to a new space, whether they're working with enough, like they've increased the number of farms to get the ingredients. Everyone has a different way of kind of addressing these issues that work for them. So this is definitely not a one size fits all approach, but a spectrum of things that people can do. And so, you know, that definitely gets to be like a complicated individual question.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel like consumers can have an influence when they go to a restaurant? Like I know I always, you know, I encourage people, you know, not necessarily not to go to the restaurant if they don't have sustainably sourced meat, but I always encourage people, even if they don't have it on the menu, to always ask so that the restaurant owner is starting to hear that people want it. Like if you go into a restaurant and say, what fish do you have that's wild caught? What chicken do you have that's organic? Do you have any sustainably raised beef? You know, if restaurant owners start hearing these questions, I feel like they will start answering the need. Do you feel like it's similar in the bar industry? Because I'm not as familiar with that.
Yeah, in general, I mean, I follow that same approach as well. And I, you know, having worked in bars for so many years, bars and restaurants, knowing that if somebody keeps asking for something, chances are higher that the owner or the buyer is going to start carrying those things because there's a demand for it. So the more that people ask, the greater the demand. I think that that does help change things. I would definitely caution a guest to walk into a bar and say, hey, where does the grain come from and the whiskey you're pouring in my old fashioned? The bartender probably won't know that. So kudos if they do know, but I would say probably don't go in and ask. But I will say that if a person is really interested in drinking sustainable spirits, there are a number of them that are out there. And so ask for them by brand name. So like if you want a gin that's produced in a more sustainable way, the Leopold Brothers makes a great one. You know, go into the bar and say, hey, do you carry Leopold Brothers? That kind of thing. Or, you know, if you're ordering a Negroni and you'd prefer a Leopold Brothers brother's gin instead of whatever their well is, asking, you know, do you have that? Can I substitute it out? So I think that there's something they can do in that way. I would also say that when you go to a liquor store and you're wanting to try these things at home, going into a store and asking a retailer, because they do have a lot of buying power and it is their job to be able to sell you things, so they should know the details about these things. I think that's really the place where consumers can go in and ask and say, hey, you know, I'm really interested in buying something that's sustainably made or produced from locally sourced grains. Do you have anything that fits that bill? And asking them to kind of guide you around. And I think that the more that consumers ask for those things in liquor stores like that, that the more that that's those products will be carried. So I think that that's something they can do. And then, you know, sometimes I am a little cautious to put the entire burden on consumers and wanting the pressure to be put on from like buyers of places. So if you're a bar operator, if you are a buyer for a liquor store, you have the power to start asking your distributors these questions and say, hey, you know, I'd really like to carry something that's more sustainably made. What do you have for me? That kind of thing. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and you're talking about gin, you know, like even, you know, Tanqueray, which is supposedly a good gin, you know, they have their higher brand, you know, 10, right? So is there one then that goes higher than that within
So I just to be completely honest, am not familiar with Tanqueray's distilling practices. And uh-huh. I really can't comment on what they're doing. They're not somebody that I chronicled in the book, but the Leopold brothers going there and visiting their distillery, there are all these systems that are in place for energy efficiency. They malt their own barley. So that means they make their own neutral grain product with, you know, so they make their own vodka, which can then be turned into gin. So, you know, gin is really just flavored vodka because you have the juniper berries in there. So they're making everything in-house. Everything is locally sourced. They're using local botanicals and really making an effort to reduce their carbon footprint, their energy use, their water consumption. So that's kind of, I'm looking at the holistic picture there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And can a liquor like vodka can be made from a variety of different grains, or is it always the same?
It can be. Yes. Yep.
Right. Sometimes I hear that's made from potato, right?
Yeah, potato. Sometimes you can make it from grape. Sometimes you can make it from wheat. You know, there's many options. Actually, one company right now is making it with coffee berries. So there's lots of options there.
Huh. Okay. You visit many different distillers in the book. Can you tell us about a couple that really stand out to you? I know you've just mentioned the Leopold brothers. So you have... you also mentioned High Wire. Any others in there?
Yeah, there's quite a few. High Wire is fantastic in Charleston, South Carolina, and whiskey is the one that I'm kind of following in the book. And then I did go to Mexico and talk to Pedro Jimenez, who's the owner of Mizonte, which is kind of like an aggregate. He works with a lot of different independent mezcal producers, and he has certain principles that he talks to the distillers about, really thinking about the environmental side of things, preserving the history and the culture in distilling, and then also thinking about the balance of the ecosystem. Like, if I want you to produce more, is this going to throw the ecosystem out of whack? So that is a really great, he's got a lot of different producers under his label, and they're really wonderful. And then I wanted to definitely think about fire and drought because I live in California and these are such big topics. So St. George Spirits, it's the oldest craft distillery, the first one to open since Prohibition. It opened in 1982. And I was really wanting to think about, you know, how are they thinking about consistency when crops are so inconsistent, when the environment is always in flux? You know, we don't know if it's going to be a fire season, if it's going to be a drought season. And they're really great. They don't add anything that's artificial. They really think about distilling the essence of a fruit or the product and showcasing that in the bottle. So they're in there. And then, you know, rum is a really big one. So I talked to one of the founders of Equiano Rum, and then also Karen Hoskin, who started Montaña. distillery. They're one of the few certified B Corp distilleries in the world. There's only a handful. And she runs one of them. And I did want to think about scale. So I ended up going to Kentucky and talking to Maker's Mark, who is really that company is really concerned about the future of their product. And they're really looking at how do they be good stewards of the land that they have their campus on and using the watershed, and how do they preserve that and use, healthy water and that kind of thing. So yeah. And the book is definitely not an exhaustive list of places that are doing things in a sustainable way. I really wanted to introduce people to this topic because often people aren't really thinking about the role that spirits play in the food system and what the impact is there. So, you know, setting up some problems, but also looking at models of people who are doing it well and thinking again about this as a spectrum of things. So there are a lot of other people that are doing things well, but this isn't a guide per se. Mm-hmm. It's just more of the what's at stake when we don't treat spirits as agricultural products.
Has anyone created a guide that you know of? Is there a guide out there?
I am not sure, but I think that would be a great thing for someone to do if they're interested.
Yeah. I think so. And what's the difference? People ask me this all the time, and I'm not really, you might not know the answer either. What's the difference between mezcal and tequila? Like all tequila comes from mezcal, right? But all mezcal is not tequila, right?
So mezcal is an umbrella term. Tequila is a type of mezcal. Mezcal can be produced from any type of agave around Mexico. And that gets a little sticky. I do explore that in the book about like some of the qualifications and limitations of mezcal. But tequila can only be produced in the state of Jalisco from Blue Weber agave. So it's one type of agave. So it's a kind of a subgenre of mezcal.
And kind of like champagne has to come from Champagne, France, right?
There are like appellations in that. Well, not appellations, but there's like denominations of origin and that kind of thing within mezcal tequila. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Interesting. I know also, you know, I'm always talking to people about wine, you know, how important it is to really try to source organic wine, because grapes, as I'm sure you know, are on that dirty dozen list, you know, every year, you know, they're one of the most heavily sprayed products. And when you're drinking wine from unorganic grapes, you know, they're heavily sprayed and then they're, you know, ground down and you're getting all that pesticides in there. What I wasn't aware of was that there's also vegan wine. I mean, I'm aware of it now, but I wasn't at some point. Can you share what is in wine that makes wine not vegan?
I actually don't know. wine is not my specialty. You know, I live in Northern California, and there are so many people who do wine and have much more knowledge of that than I do. I will say in spirits, though, there are things that are not vegan spirits. Like an alternative to like Campari, instead of that red dye number 40, they're actually these bitter aperitifs that can go in a Negroni. They're dyed with cochineal beetles. So if there's the beetle there, it's not technically considered vegan.
Yes, I've heard about those red beetles, right? Uh-huh. What else could be in a spirit that would not be vegan? And how would someone know? Do you need to, ask the bartender or?
The bartender might know what's vegan and what's not. I would say that most are vegan, but the ones with natural dyes like a cochineal beetle wouldn't be, but I don't actually know of many others that are not vegan. Uh-huh. Unless it's distilled with like, there was a producer locally that was doing something with oysters, distilling with oyster shells. So something like that wouldn't be considered vegan.
And aren't there worms in the bottom of mezcal?
Not the stuff that I'm talking about. I would say don't buy a bottle of mezcal or tequila with a worm in it.
Okay. All right. I'll share that. So what else in your book would you like to share with us? What have I not asked you about that you would like to share?
Well, I think that there's a lot of hope in the way that people are doing things. I, you know, didn't want to write a book that was all gloom and doom. And I think that there are people that are doing things really well and creating these models. And I really wanted to just show people that this is possible. People are thinking about it. And hopefully, you know, the people who are doing things in their own various corners can come together and create a community. But I also will say that the book is written in a more of a narrative form. So it's less like, here are the facts. You know, there are definitely facts and factual information in there. But because some of these topics can be hard as a reader to engage with, especially when you're talking about the environment, and it can be very overwhelming, I wanted to tell these things like a story. So I'm hopefully taking the reader where they can't go on these journeys. So it's kind of told through a perspective of me learning these about these issues as well. So to create hopefully an engaging connection point for the reader.
And as a bartender, what are some of your favorite drinks to make using some of these natural juices and stuff?
Well, one of my favorite cocktails to make is a Oaxacan Old Fashioned, which is a mixture of tequila and mezcal with agave syrup instead of like sugar. And then a couple different types of bitters. I love making that drink. I take a lot of pride in that one. But I will say one drink that I have a very, very special place in my heart is the Pisco Sour, because it was the first fancy cocktail that I ever learned how to make when I was in my early 20s. It involved, you know, cutting a lime in half and juicing it by hand and measuring it, and then also cracking a fresh egg and getting the egg white in there. So it was and then you shake the drink without ice to froth up the egg white, and then you add ice and you reshake it, and then you strain it into the coupe glass, and it just has this like beautiful foam on the top, and it's just beautiful and very satisfying to make with my hands. So that was the first fancy one I learned how to make, and I will always have a very special place in my heart for it.
Yeah, we love those down in Peru.
Yeah.
They were really, you know, that's the place I had it first time. But now, since I've been to Peru, I have stopped eating eggs. So what can someone substitute an egg for in a Pisco Sour? Would you be able to make a vegan one?
Yeah, I've actually heard that people have, that's a great question. And I also think an opportunity for someone to come up with an alternative. Instead of egg, though, I have heard of people using a whey instead, like W-E-Y, you know, leftover, if you have cheese or something, the whey from
there. Yeah, but then that's not vegan either.
Right. So I don't quite know about the vegan.
I don't think the aquafaba would be very good in it. You know, aquafaba, that's the juice from chickpeas. I think that would give it a flavor. It might not be appealing.
Yeah. I'll look into that. I'll get back to you. I'm not sure.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Because I'll share it with my listeners, because I do have a following that is also vegan. And what other liqueurs are really entering this special marketplace? You know, vodka, gin, rum. We talked about mezcal. And whiskey, right? What else?
There's brandy. I think that there are, you know, Pisco is a type of brandy. So I just focus on the large categories, and those are really the big ones. With liqueurs, I will say that, again, going back to Leopold Brothers, because they make their own base spirit and they add like real fruit and things like that. They're not adding anything chemical. Mm-hmm. They have a huge line of liqueurs, like a maraschino liqueur, a cherry liqueur. There's a whole list of things that they have, and those are really fantastic and widely available. And I think that there's a place in the market for these naturally flavored liqueurs to emerge as well.
Yeah. And also with the colors, because, you know, it's the liqueurs that so often you see at the bar, you know, bright green, bright blue, bright red. And, you know, you just look at those and you just think that they can't be natural. And I've heard about the Beatles before for red, but what about the other colors? Are they all artificially produced?
I would guess yes. I would guess yes. If you know, the bright blue, the bright green, I don't know how else it would be colored without food dye.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing really that would naturally, you know, normally these things are kind of like a much duller, less vibrant colors. And that's why that those dyes are added to give it color, to make it pop. To you, when you're walking around a store, you lock eyes with it and say, oh, that's what I'm going to buy because it's a pretty color, but uh-huh. not naturally flavored.
Right. What else do you recommend for my listeners to experiment with? If they're going into a restaurant and they want to try another drink that they maybe are not familiar with, do you have other ones besides the Oaxacan Old Fashioned Pisco Sour that you would recommend people giving a try to?
Yeah, you know, I'm a big fan of classic cocktails. So there's lots of classic cocktails that are kind of hidden gems. You know, I'm trying to think of things that wouldn't necessarily have artificial ingredients in it off the top of my head. But I will also say that usually when you're going into a restaurant and a bartender has spent the time to put together a cocktail menu, it's always really nice to try something on their menu because they've spent the time, they've done the research. Sometimes when you ask for something off the menu, it might not taste the way that you'd expect because they haven't had time to do R&D on it and really kind of dial in the recipe. But you know, I'm also a big fan of simple drinks that do highlight the base spirit. So old fashions, gimlets are really great. Even a margarita, if you're interested in trying a different type of mezcal or tequila, margaritas really let that base spirit shine. I'm a big fan of three ingredient cocktails too. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And what about coffee espressos? Coffee martinis, do they use real coffee in those or are those artificially flavored?
St. George makes a really delicious coffee liqueur that is naturally flavored. It's their Nola. That is really fantastic. And I've heard that espresso martinis are having a moment right now. And the Nola is a great liqueur to try in those.
Okay. I hope everyone's taking notes. I know I am. Okay. Wow, this is really wonderful because you're the first person I've had on to actually talk about liquor. You know, I'm so focused all the time on food. And I too, you know, other than like, as I said, you know, thinking about organic wine, which I really promote, and organic beer, I really haven't given it that much thought in the liquor realm. And it's fascinating to, you know, you see these, you know, $100 bottles popping up and less. And just really wondering, you know, is it worth it? Is it not worth it? And it's nice to hear that, you know, that people are really trying to give it some thought and thinking about how they're sourcing the ingredients and knowing that it makes a difference.
Yeah.
We are what we eat and we are what we drink, right?
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
So they're both. So if people are interested in getting your book, will they find it on Amazon and most bookstores?
Yes. Bookshop.org, great alternative to Amazon. You can also buy it on Island Press's website. That's the publisher. They have it there. Or go to your local bookstore and ask for it there. If they don't have it, they can order it. But a lot of bookstores do have it. So, yeah.
And can you tell us just a little bit more background with what you do in your regular day job at the Oral History Center? What does an interviewer do at the Oral History Center?
Yeah, so I do long form life history interviews with people. The interviews are usually about 2 hours, anywhere up to, you know, 20 or 30 hours. They happen in multiple sessions over a period of time. And we like to start at the beginning of someone's life and work forward to the present to kind of get a sense of who they are, how they became who they are, what are the things that they are most proud of in their life, their contributions, that kind of thing. And everything is recorded, transcribed, and then it's archived. So all the interviews are publicly available after they're done. And we have we've been around since 1953. So we have well over 4,000 interviews on many, many, many different topics, including the environment and the culinary world. We have quite a few interviews with chefs and distillers at this point. So lots of topics. It's a great job.
So does UC Berkeley go out and, they have an idea of who they want to interview and they approach the person? Because I'm a big fan of StoryCorps. Are you familiar with StoryCorps?
Yeah.
NPR's?
I am. This is a little different because these are much longer interviews and we have a staff of interviewers that are trained in oral history to do the interviews. So we're kind of like professional biographers. I should also say that our office is a nonprofit. We're soft money. We don't really receive any university support financially. So we have to do a lot of grant writing and secure funding before we do a project. And then it really depends on the project and the funding stream about who we're approaching. So, if we get a grant from, let's say, the National Park Service, we can go out and select those narrators for that project, speaking on whatever points that we want to talk to them about, versus, if somebody contracts us to do an oral history, they may have a group of people that they want interviewed on their minds already. So it's give and take.
Right, right. Well, that makes sense. I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It's been really just so informative. I will recommend your book to people out there because it's really fascinating. Like I said, I just have not really explored the world of spirits before. And I certainly will because I know a lot of people that really like them. And so I will expand my repertoire for spirits. And, I would think that, as a chef, just making the drinks that can go in with the liqueur. I know I've certainly done, watermelon punch type drinks. And, when I have melons and things like that, it's always delicious to mix with liquor. So
yeah,
I will continue to do that.
Yeah.
But anyway, Shanna, thank you so much for joining us. And everyone out there, thank you so much for joining us. It's been wonderful. And you've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Bye for now.